I'm here on the job site with Dale, who's a framing contractor.
Hey, good morning.
Dale traded up to Geico Commercial Auto Insurance for all his business vehicles. We're here where he needs us most.
Yep, they sure are.
We make it easy for him to save on all his insurance needs, all in one place, with coverage that fits his business and bottom line. Oh, I shouldn't have looked down.
It's all right.
We're so far up here.
Look at me. Take a deep breath.
Oh, I'm good. So good.
Get a commercial auto insurance quote today at geico.com and see how much you could save. Get more with Geico.
Hello and welcome to the Full of Beans podcast, hosted by myself, Hannah, a registered associate nutritionist and your favourite crazy bean. Full of Beans is on a mission to reduce eating disorder stigma and increase eating disorder awareness. Together, we will establish inspiring conversations with a range of individuals, including those with personal experience and their loved ones, as well as clinicians, researchers, and charities who are all working to increase the understanding of eating disorders. Using my personal battle with atypical anorexia and body dysmorphia, as well as my master's in eating disorders and clinical nutrition, we will together explore the experiences of like-minded individuals who are equally as passionate about sharing their stories to increase the understanding of eating disorders. Please note that this podcast discusses sensitive topics and should not be seen as a replacement for evidence-based therapy or treatment. Today I'm joined by Tom Robert. Tom has his own experience of anorexia nervosa and has since then worked with an adult service within the NHS and has worked with the Prince's Trust. Tom joins us today to share his incredible experience. Hello, Tom.
Hello, everyone.
How are you today?
Yeah, I'm good. I'm good.
After the stress of not being able to hear each other for about 10 minutes.
Yeah, it's technology for you. The old peas would be proud of technology not working again.
Yes, I think we're going to have to look at a new way of recording because the way that I'm currently doing it, nobody can seem to get the hang of, so maybe I'm overcomplicating it. Anyway, thank you so much for joining me today. I'm really excited to talk to you about your experience and all the work that you've been doing. So I wondered if you wanted to start by just sharing with us kind of, I guess, your personal experience of your eating disorder.
Yeah, by all means. Always willing to share a story, I guess, or two. I'll kind of go back from my childhood, really. I think that's kind of a good start. Obviously, I didn't suffer with an eating disorder then, but I've always kind of felt, it's going to sound really cliche, but I always felt different. In some ways, I hate that word, but in some ways, I love it because it kind of really sums up the way I felt. But at the same time, it was just like a mix of things, and I never was able to put a finger on it, sort of thing. But later on in the podcast, we might be able to find out what that thing was. So we'll hold on to that one as we go on. I had a hard time at school. I found school very difficult. I was diagnosed dyslexic, and school life, when you're dyslexic or struggling with spelling and reading and things like that, it's damn tough. It's damn tough. You're facing that problem like all the time, basically, aren't you? As I kind of got a bit older, I struggled a lot with anxiety when I was really young, more than what I do now. But at the time, there wasn't like a word for it. It was really weird when I think back to how much I did actually suffer with my mental health. Mm-hmm. But actually, it wasn't talked about. It wasn't kind of discussed kind of like this, really, I guess. So I felt like I was the only one kind of going through the way I felt with things. Is now looking back on it, I realize I was far from it, and there'd be lots of people who kind of felt the same. As school went on and I got a bit older, I couldn't deal with the stresses of exams and SATs. And basically, my family, my mum said, shout up to those who were up north for mum.
I was going to say, one of my friends has just moved to Newcastle and she's not originally from Newcastle, and she started saying mam, and I was like, where's this come from?
It's a way to be, mam. So yeah, my mam kind of had a kind of big fight and stuff to kind of get his to not do me sats at a young age. That kind of set us off from when I went into the next school in middle school. When I went to my middle school slash high school, the first day I had a look at my sats and they said that he hasn't done them. And we said, yeah, we know, because he gets too stressed and it causes too many problems. So they kind of took that as, I don't know why, but they took that as, he obviously can't do them and he can't write anything or he can't read anything. So they literally put his like into a class that I was learning like first school things.
Right.
Learning how to read from the start, basically. And after a while, after being in that middle school for a year, it took a year to fight to kind of get us out, because I remember the day, it was funny in a way, because I remember I got an assessment with somebody who was high up in education, a teacher who was high up in education, and she sat us down one day and she gave us a book. I remember it was a Biff and Chip book back in them days with Biff and Chip. And she said, oh, I want you to read it. And I read the whole book out loud. And the look on her face, she just about fell off the chair. Like, to see you can read. And I was like, yeah, I know I can read. And she was like, oh, I want you to write down this. And I read down like a paragraph or something. She says, you can write. Yes, there's a few words there that are not correct, but you can pretty much write. And I was like, I know. And they were like, oh my God, you're in the wrong class. And I was like, I know. So it was all a bit higgly piggly. And then we had to fight really hard to get into another class. But I met some really, really nice people there. They did struggle with it. And they had to really start from scratch. And they also had, I think some of them were like in care homes and they had a hard time, really hard time. So I really felt for them and gave them respect. And I think they knew that. And I think that's why they give me a lot of respect. So, but then as I got to high school and I moved classes, the tables kind of changed. I was in a better class for me education wise, but for sociability wise, and just being friends with people, it was the worst. The bullied is to hell. They made me life absolute misery. One point pushed us down the stairs. They'd done lots of things, and basically I was just bullied to bits for a good few years. Eventually led to a breakdown. I remember I woke up and obviously every day I was waking up just not wanting to go to school, not wanting to face it. And this one day I started not making myself sick, but I was being sick sort of thing. It was like an anxiety thing. It was like, because I was so anxious, so nervous, I was just being sick at this point. Again, my family said, my mom said, enough's enough, you're going to have to stay off school. And I ended up staying off school for about 7 weeks, 8 weeks. And in that time, the deputy headmaster came to my house.
Wow. Which
was, yeah, it was quite scary.
Yeah, but I thought, you might think, what the hell is happening here?
Yeah. Basically, he just came and says, you've got to go back to school. And I was, oh. No, he was really good, actually. Being fair, it wasn't what I thought. It wasn't until years later that my mom said that they told her that actually Tom looks very unwell. It kind of really shows how much people might say, talking about mental health and sense of, people might say, oh, you just got a bit of anxiety. No, anxiety can be an absolute life-crippling thing. It can be, it can lead to breakdowns. It can lead to not being able to cope, to do basic tasks. Anxiety shouldn't be just seen as just a fritter of, oh, you've just got a bit of anxiety. It is serious. You can kind of manage it yourself, but you've got to kind of keep a hold of that. Everything, you've got to kind of take aware of it and take care of it and take care of yourself. But it can be life debilitating, really. So anyway, getting back, I got into his second top and I said, I could do it. So anyways, he went away and then he rang me and he says, I've moved you in at the class you wanted. As that time went on, I realised actually I wasn't just in that class struggling at thought. I was actually in that class performing about average level of the class. I was happy. So it kind of really just showed that when you're happy and when you feel relaxed and confident, then things come out and you can work so much better when you're in good health, basically. Mm-hmm. And that was kind of the real start of mental health for me. And that was going right back from when I was probably about 8. And then going later on in life, I thought I would leave school, everything would be fine, hunky-dory, get a job, and that would be the end of it. But not to be the case. Left school, and again, really struggled with kind of leaving school, in a sense. I started just going to the gym, started just working out. I thought, you know, I want to get better, get fitter. I thought lots of people were doing it. I thought, oh, I'll join in, be something sociable, something enjoyable. And it was for about a year. I started seeing results, started feeling better, but then I don't know what happened. It just something changed. Lots of things. There was a lot of family issues. There was somebody I was losing. So again, I was dealing with grief. Yeah, I didn't know where to go, what to do. That I put a lot of pressure on myself to know. Basically, I got too much into the exercise. I started working out more. I started kind of feeling, oh, I have to do this. I have to go out. Rather than, oh, yeah, I fancy it. Or as food was concerned, I basically just, I didn't really change a lot. I guess it was just, I just increased everything I was doing activity-wise, but I wasn't increasing the amount of food. I was probably slightly decreasing it by taking away certain things. Just that ongoing process for a while, things just started to sneak in. I became more aggressive, more angry, which isn't me. I hate being angry. I hate being aggressive. Yeah, and then it kind of just built from there, really. The eating disorder really took a hold. I really felt like I couldn't have certain foods. The exercise was absolutely obsessive. I was training anywhere I could. I was on my feet all the time. At the time, I had a part-time job. So I think that kind of crept in of, oh, well, I haven't got time for lunch. I haven't got time to do this. Things just crept in, and that's the thing with an eating disorder. That's the scary thing, is things just creep up and slide in without even knowing it's kind of happening.
Yeah.
And physically wise, I became very unwell. Mentally wise, I was kind of, hard to say, really non-existent, really. I was just, a simple task is, I remember it was a bit of a turning point for me when I was doing my job, and it was just to make sandwiches, and I had to just cut them up, and I couldn't think to how to cut a sandwich. I couldn't think. Somebody showed us, and then I couldn't do it. I couldn't. And I remember thinking to myself, what the hell is going on? I just couldn't do it. It was the most bizarre thing ever. I literally couldn't hold the bread at the same time as cut. That was a bit of a turning point for me, because I suddenly thought, what is going on? Obviously, I knew something was going on, but what was going on? But at the same time, I kind of didn't want to accept it. I think that's a big thing with an eating disorder, is you're kind of in very much denial, aren't you? You're very much, this is not happening, it's something else. At one point, I thought it was a stroke. That I had a stroke during the night or something. And a lot kind of goes on, and it was really hard. Physically, I was changing colour. My skin was turning like more of a yellowy colour. Oh. I was getting a lot of heart problems as well. That was a big thing for me. At one point, we thought I had a heart attack because I was getting pains down my left arm and in my chest, and it was quite severe.
I've got so many questions that I want to ask you, and I just want to say thank you for being so honest, because I think a lot of the time we can, I don't know, it feels almost like once we're recovered, it's you don't want to talk about the really difficult parts. So thank you for kind of sharing so much. And I thought it was really interesting what you said about the anxiety and not really having a word for it when you were younger. But then you also said about how anxiety now is sort of seen as, you know, just something that's kind of a little bit of an inconvenience, but it can actually be crippling. And I don't know, I kind of wanted to ask you the question, was why do you think that is? Do you think now we just use the word so flippantly, like, oh, I feel a bit anxious today, and it's sort of taken the extremity out of it? Or, you know, why do you think that it's not being taken as seriously as it should be?
First thing is, I love hogging the mic, so yeah. So at any point, just tell us to shut up. I think we do use it flippantly, which is not necessarily a bad thing in the sense of it does help to create awareness. Majority of the time, like 80% of the time, things we do in terms of causing anxiety can't just be small. It can't just be like, if you're scared of heights and you're going up a high building, you'll get anxiety because you're scared of heights. And it's not a problem to kind of maybe, oh, I'll go that level higher, or I'll try a couple more steps. There's nothing wrong with that. But I think sometimes, like you say, I think it will have got to be that 20% be careful of, is this anxiety changing my life? Is this anxiety affecting my life? So if somebody was to say to me, oh, I'm scared of going on heights, I don't go anything tall buildings, but their overall life is not being affected. They're living quite happily. They've got quite a nice life. They're just content with themselves and everything's fine. But if they said, oh no, I'm limited to this, I'm stopped doing this, I've stopped doing that, I used to love bungee jump and I used to love this and I'm not doing that, that's when I would say that is not good. That is, the anxiety is really crippling, and that's where we've got to kind of really be careful. And I think it's that sense of looking at, just trying to open it up to that. If somebody's kind of zooming their life in because of an anxiety, that is really dangerous and life crippling, basically.
I do often think that about a lot of things. I've had quite a lot of conversations with people about exercise on the podcast, and it's the same sort of thing, that if you're engaging in exercise and you go every day, but it's actually something you're really enjoying, it's not something that you feel you have to do, it's just you genuinely enjoy it and it makes you feel good, fantastic. But it's very similar to what you were saying about the anxiety, and that if it's crippling and it gets to the point where, you know, you can't miss a day, you have to do it all the time, you know, there's so many rules and restrictions around the exercise, then that is when it's an issue. So I think that's a really good point that you've made about the anxiety. And the other thing that I wanted to kind of, I guess, ask you a bit more about was, you said, you know, when the eating sort of behaviour started coming in, you didn't really notice them. It almost sounded like you were saying that they were like unconscious kind of rules that you were making. But then when it kind of came to, okay, I think there's now an issue, you didn't really want to admit that there was an issue. How do you like navigate that? Because it almost sounds like it kind of crept in, but then when you got to the point of things were quite serious, you still didn't really notice it.
It is a really hard one, and I know exactly what you mean. Like you say, like the signs, the symptoms were there when I look back. And when I think back to things that happened, I remember I could go on for ages telling you different stories of different things of times. Like I went to a football match, was one of them, and basically I can't remember much of this football match to save my life. And it was only about 3 days later, I think I was in hospital after that. I remember that day more when we went to get a meal, and I think I had a meal actually, and I'd also ordered a bit of cake as well, and I had the cake as well, but the guilt and the anger, you know, to me, I felt so much anger. I felt like I've got to get rid of this anger. So it was like, oh well, I'll go and do exercise. So that was like a cheeky way of it kind of slipping back in, you know. It was kind of a cheeky way of it kind of like, oh well, if you do the exercise, then you're kind of using whatever you've done, and all them thoughts were kind of like subsiding. It's very clever on how it kind of like slides in. And I remember just feeling all that anger and guilt, and I just thought myself, there's something not right, but I didn't know what, I didn't know where to start. And I think deep down, I think what it was I didn't want it to change, but deep down I did want it to change, because I wanted to be able to just go out, have a meal, have a bit of cake, and walk away and not think twice of it, which is what should happen. I should be able to go to a football match, have a laugh, have a joke, if you can, if you're old enough, have a drink, have cake, and just enjoy yourself, have a good time. But instead, I just remember feeling like I just wanted to be swallowed up. I just wanted to disappear into a hole of nothing. I didn't want any stresses. I didn't want any kind of worries, to a sense. I just didn't want anything. I just wanted to be left alone in a dark hole, is all I can describe. And it's just horrible and really sad. Yeah, I think that's why I kind of, in some ways, I didn't go to receive the help, but I did kind of accept the help once my family kind of got it, because I was, in a way, so much pain. I suppose when you get to a point with physical health, if you're in pain, you would kind of do anything to kind of stop the pain. And after a while, you really do just do anything you can to stop it. So I think, to me, I got to a point where I was so sick of the pain in my head from the way I felt. I just thought, I do want to kind of stop this. And that's kind of when my family kind of said, right, basically, he has the help. We can kind of get you on the right track.
And what sort of thing did you, I'm quite interested what you were saying about how you ate the cake and then you went and exercised. And I think it's quite common, but it's quite a strong negative reinforcement in that, okay, you can have the cake, but then you have to exercise afterwards. And I think then it becomes a repetitive pattern where you cannot then have anything without then needing to exercise. How did you break that cycle of needing to exercise after you'd finished eating?
I'd done that when I was in like inpatient unit, basically, and I'd done that by literally just not doing it, as simple as it sounds and as obvious as it sounds. That was kind of it, really, just kind of not doing it. But that's the weird thing with me, just like I was saying at the start, when I kind of want something and I really go for something, I can kind of flip to a positive. So I can kind of like really flip in. And that's the way when I got help and when I've been through different times of recovery and stuff through this, I've thought, right, I really want to kind of go through this and I really want to kind of conquer this and the way I felt. And I've been able to just suffer that kind of horrible time of obviously not doing any exercise, eating everything they've told us to eat, getting up to a healthy weight, getting up to where I need to be really quick. In a lot of ways, I think some of the medical staff have been people who don't understand it will say they've been impressed, but then some people who do understand it will say they'll be alarmed a bit, because sometimes it can be too quick and it can be seen as a way of kind of it getting out. And I think for me, sometimes it is, because it's sometimes a way of, I feel that all I've got to do is concentrate. When I'm in a hospital setting, all you've got to do is just concentrate on getting well, looking after it yourself. And I can kind of do that. But obviously when you get out of a hospital, as life goes on, you have to juggle like 10 plates at once, don't you? It's like, you've got a job here, you've got this to do here, you've got that to do here. Or at the same time, by the way, you've got your washing and ironing. Oh, and by the way, you've got like a house to clean. Oh, and to add on that, now just wash a car because you've learned how to drive It's like, whoopee. So, trying to spin all them plates for me, I think I sometimes feel quite difficult. And then I take it out on me health, and I take it out. The way I show that and the way I express it is via the eating disorder, is via kind of saying I can't do with this, and I end up going back to the eating disorder, doing a lot of exercise, doing under eating, not being able to cope. And then obviously it kind of snowballs, because I think I start with the knowing I can control it, but then it just, I just lose it a bit, and I just kind of get too into it. And as time goes on, and as times I've had where I've relapsed and then came out of it, I've been able to know the signs a lot better and know what it is. So I do just stop it a lot quicker these days, and I know what my mind's playing and how I feel, sort of thing.
Yeah. It's interesting you say about that when you were doing recovery, because it sounds, I think anorexia especially is very like black and white, all or nothing thinking. So I think it's not uncommon for people to just switch it, like you said, and okay, well, I'm doing recovery now, so I'm going full pelt into recovery. But then, like you say, when normal life comes knocking on the door, you can't have your full 100% on recovery all the time, because you do have, like you said, there's so many little things that you have to focus on. But equally, I think how you spoke about recovery is how I personally see recovery anyway, is that, you know, you might have days where you think, I can't cope with this today. Like, there's too much going on. I need my eating disorder as my comfort blanket. But it's recognizing those signs, or that, you know, if you have a voice in your head, not everybody does, but like for me personally, it's often when I'm struggling, that little negative self-talk comes in. And I think it's just recognizing that and having the skills to then manage that and not let it escalate. That's what recovery is. I personally think anyway, thinking that you're going to never have a disordered thought again, probably unrealistic, but being able to cope with it and manage it, that's kind of the realistic idea. I don't know what you think about that.
Yeah, I would fully agree. And just there, I was like a nodding dog. I was like one of them fake dogs that you used to have in your car, didn't you? That used to nod all the time.
Like Churchill.
That was me there. Yeah, Churchill. I totally agree. And it is totally black and white. And like you say, life isn't totally black and white. Life is so grey. A lot of people who suffer with an eating disorder might suffer with that. And it's not a bad thing. And I think it can be seen as like a good thing, but like you say, it's just learning about trying to, how can we get on it, like, not, it's just learning yourself, learning your own ways to cope with things. I could say ways, but it might not help somebody else.
Yeah,
it's a really up and down roller coaster, and it's a really hard roller coaster to learn, because it is kind of, you kind of got to do it to kind of see if it works, and if it doesn't, yes, it hasn't worked. So somebody would say, oh, well, that's a fail. But to me, it isn't a fail. It's, you just know that that doesn't work.
Yeah.
It's more
that's
of a
life, though.
Yeah, yeah.
Don't try it. If it doesn't work, try something else.
Yeah, yeah. Sometimes we'll do it again as well. And we'll think, oh, well, we're even more daft to do it again. But sometimes you have to do it again, actually. So actually, no, it really isn't going to work, because you feel like the situation's changed or something, so you think, oh, it might work again, but no. There's no one route for recovery, and there's no one simple way of it. And like you say, it's all just kind of, it's a bit of a mess, to be honest. It's just a mess.
Yeah, I think that's such an important thing to say, though, because sometimes I do worry, like when I get people on the podcast and I'm like, oh, can you explain your journey? And everyone seems to have it kind of laid out, and, you know, this happened, and I got an eating disorder and then I recovered. And it sounds very sort of linear and smooth. But I guess, one, I think sometimes we just explain it in that way because it's easy to listen to. But two, when you're in the depth of an eating disorder, you've got no idea why it's happened, what's going on, nothing. It's through having years of therapy and unpicking things and working out, oh, maybe that was what triggered it, or maybe that was. But even then, I still don't think that we could ever pin down one significant or tiny point in our life and be like, yeah, that's what it was.
Yeah, definitely. I think we say it very linear. Well, I say it very, very linear, because basically I write it on a notepad and then just read it off the notepad. That's it, you know. No, I don't think I would have a notepad big enough, unfortunately. It is just exactly that. It's there's no linear way, and it's all really kind of confusing. I think one way that's really helped me, and it was the one thing I was going to come to, and that is, a couple of years ago, I was diagnosed being autistic, and there's more and more research coming out that basically a lot of people possibly with an eating disorder do suffer with being autistic. And that would kind of show for a lot of things in terms of black and white and being able to do one thing, or like going like guns blazing at one thing and then being able, like, once that's kind of done, going guns blazing somewhere else and not being able to kind of juggle loads of things at once and having that gray area. And so if there is somebody out there listening and they are struggling and they feel like that, then see, have a look in maybe being diagnosed, getting diagnosed being autistic or something might help you to just feel like you understand yourself better, or it might just help to learn about different things you could do. You could even just, not even that, you could just research it and just look it up and see if that has any help, or look into it, because I've seen there's a lot of, there's big links to it, which I would kind of agree in some ways.
We I did a podcast, it was a few months ago now, with a girl called Charlie, who she's doing her PhD on the link between anorexia and autism and looking into how services can be more suitable for people with anorexia, with autism, because the way that it needs to be treated is quite different and the kind of approach towards it needs to be different. And I think it's also quite interesting that sometimes when somebody is in the depth of an eating disorder, they might not have autism, but sometimes the eating disorder can sort of cause more autistic traits. But I think, like you say, there's quite a lot of correlation between it, like the rigid thinking, the black and white thinking, like you said, the perfectionism, sort of having, I guess, maybe like a certain obsession with particular things. Did you get diagnosed with autism after you'd experienced the eating disorder?
It was kind of in between. So I've had it, like when I first got diagnosed with an eating disorder, I was kind of, didn't know I was. My family had an idea I was, because it was always mentioned when I was little. I just never officially got diagnosed. It wasn't until I was about 20. So I've kind of had times where I have been a bit unwell. I've said, oh, look, I'm being diagnosed with autism. It's hard to tell if they've changed things. I don't know. Possibly in therapy, if I've had therapy after I've been diagnosed, might have changed the way that we're going to do things. Because I remember speaking to somebody once and I'll have to scrap all that then. And then I didn't know what she kind of meant by that. So obviously she obviously had some idea of something. And then obviously after I've said that, it's obviously changed something. I don't know. And then the next time I saw her, it was all just felt like normal. Really, it didn't mean any different. But it's been actually, I thought I wouldn't want it, in the sense of it feels like I've always felt like I've had labels from the day I was kind of born. I felt like I've had that from it, like having the dyslexia and the mental health and then the eating disorder and then now the autism, and it's like, oh no, not another one. But it's really helped us to understand myself, and the good thing is sometimes it can be hard to explain to people why I might do the odd thing that might seem a bit different or a bit odd, and people say, oh, why are you doing it? And the quickest way is just to say, oh, well, look, I am autistic. And then sometimes people will just kind of, all right, and they'll take it a bit better. They might not get exactly why I've done that, but it kind of gives them some answer to it. So for me, it has helped a lot.
Yeah, that's really good. And a question I have, I guess, on the subject of when we were talking about kind of the way that they maybe, possibly, we don't know, changed your treatment when you got the autism diagnosis, was what impact do you think you being a man had on your diagnosis? Do you think that you were treated differently, or do you think that you should have been treated differently to how they might treat a woman that's got an eating disorder?
The biggest thing with being a man and an eating disorder wasn't so much treatment, in the sense once I got it, it was more getting it. I remember I was in a hospital bed, I was very unwell, and my consultant basically came up to us and said, look, we can't get you a bed, which, if you're in that situation, it's no shock horror there. unfortunately, there's such a shortage of beds, which is terrible, really. But then she said, actually, you're in a really hard situation. I went, what do you mean? She says, well, majority of the places that would normally take people, I can't actually put you in there. And I said, why? And she says, because you're male. And I thought, what? And she went, yeah, they'll only take on females. And I just, for that second, it was just like, eh? Like, yeah. where we're living? like knock us on the head a bit? Like, what? I just couldn't kind of, yeah, I was just in disbelief. And she says, yeah, so you're really restricted to like only a few places in the country you can go to because they'll take on mixed gender, whereas a lot of places they'll just take female only. And I was just like, what? That's surely got to change, or that's not right. Or yeah, so that was like the real big kind of shock. And then there's a lot of, when you do get treatment and stuff, I think there's a lot of not, it's really hard when you go inpatient. If you go, when I went inpatient, it is hard because there's only like, there might be 20 people, and there's probably, there was only like myself that was male or somebody else. So there might only be 2 years that are male and another 18 patients are female. And it can be hard in the sense of like, you just kind of, you do feel like different, but it never bothered me to an extent, really, as long as I got on with them and as long as they were just, as we say up north, canny, as long as they're canny.
What does that mean?
Just like, it just means like they're just lovely people, they're just nice people, canny.
Oh, okay. I would not have said that, so I'm glad I asked.
Yeah, by all means, yeah, we say it up north, say it in the northeast a lot. It's dead canny. He's dead canny, him. It's dead nice. Nice, friendly, approachable, something like that. So good. That's all really that bothered me. I wasn't bothered whether it was male or female, to be honest, but I was just shocked at the beds. There's so many little beds for men, really is. There was, when I was in an inpatient, they had it like really sectioned off. It was like, it was like the dark ages, I felt, because it was like a really sectioned off bed. Oh, this is just where the men's is and this is just where the female. And that to me was more upsetting because it was like, well, like, why does it have to be so sectioned and so like, regimented to male and female? I couldn't get my head around. And yeah, I just felt like it was really wrong.
Was this a while ago or just interested?
This was, oh, I must have been 18 at the time.
Okay.
18, 19. So I'm now just at 26. So
okay,
you're looking about 6-7 years ago.
Yeah, so hopefully that's not the case anymore. I don't know, but...
Yeah, hopefully not. Hopefully things have changed, but I have my doubts. I think there'll be more beds. I do think there'll be more beds because there are more people talking about it, and it does seem to be more of a acceptance of men with eating disorders now, but I still think there'll be quite a bit of... yeah, shortage. If you look at like a graph, if you probably had like the number of beds to male, I think it would be a huge difference, and a huge just bit imbalance. And yeah,
how do you think we change that? Because I mean, this is something that I'm always very interested in kind of talking about, because I think, you know, if we think about the way that I guess the rhetoric of eating disorder is are seen, I think most people, not people that are obviously trying to raise awareness of eating disorders, but a lot of people that maybe don't know a lot about them, will think that they're a middle class bright white British young female girl problem, which is completely not the case. But I guess I always think, how do we change that rhetoric? Because unless we reach communities that are still talking about that, it's going to stay like that. And it's great to have these conversations and to raise awareness, but I don't know, that's something that I'm massively passionate about, but it's kind of how to break through that stigma.
Yeah. I think it's just about not focusing. It's just years of focusing on one area, isn't it? So it's going to take, unfortunately, years to unpick it. Years to kind of do these types of things, do podcasts, do different things, do interviews, and get just a variety of people who survive with it, and really show that, like, this illness doesn't discriminate anyone. It will happen to anyone at any time in their life. There's no age to it. There's no gender to it. There's no anything. It's just literally anyone can get it. A lot of people, yeah, would be shocked. Like when I said, "Oh, I've got an eating disorder," and they would say, "Oh, you? But you're a male." I would say, "Yes, I'm a male. Last time I looked, I was definitely a male. Still am." And then there's like stigmas within that, I think, as well. I think there's a, like, there's, for me, there's a big stigma of, oh, well, you're male, and it's not to get at anyone, but I think there's a big stigma of, oh, well, if you're male, then you must be seen as he's gay. Mm-hmm. And it's like, no, I'm not. And anyone can get this, and anyone can be affected. And I think that's a big stigma. Oh, well, if you're male, then you must be gay. And you must just like the way you look. And it's just not the case. It's just, I don't even know where it came from, what caused it. But honestly, if I could kind of like burn it out of people's minds or burn it out of society, I really would. It's just a horrible thing, I think. I think it's just a really horrible thing because it's just offending everyone. It's offending people who are not. It's offending people who maybe are. And it's just something that shouldn't be there, that it's there, but I think a way to unpick it is keep talking about it, keep raising it up. Over time will come and change will happen. We are seeing the change. I think that's the positive that we have got to take out of things. Like, even from when I was talking about when I was really young, I've seen a change in mental health, positive change, a good change. But that's not to say like we're finished, like kind of stop raising the awareness. Not like, not at all. Like, we've got a long way to go and a lot to do still, but it's getting there.
I mean, I'm aware we've been talking for quite a while, but I want to ask you about the work that you've been doing. So I just wondered if you could kind of, give us a kind of overview maybe of what you've within the NHS. And I know also you were working with the Princess Trust as well, which sounds like incredible work. So I wondered if you could, you know, what are you doing to raise that awareness?
Yeah, so the Prince just been great. Again, I could talk for hours talking about the things that have happened, people that I've seen. The best part for me was public speaking. I love public speaking, something I never thought I would ever be interested in. It's actually inspired us to, I've just signed up to doing a drama course.
Wow.
So in September, so September this year, I'm hoping to get back into, I've done it at school, but that was it. But I've always fancied doing it. And so signed up to doing a bit of drama and see what happens. Who knows? That's
fantastic.
Hollywood, here we come.
Well, I'll get your autograph for when you're rich and famous.
But yeah, the Prince is just really good. That helped us in a really funny time of, I just kind of left inpatient, but I couldn't work at the same time. You can't just jump from inpatient to just work. That's just not possible. It's not doable. But at the same time, sitting in a house, dwelling on your thoughts, it's not going to do anyone any good. Never mind somebody who's struggling with their mental health. So the really kind of came at that point where I needed to be at the house. I needed to do something like with a bit of a routine, but obviously something that's not stressful and obviously something that's not causing any kind of commitment as such to it. It's just, you go there, you enjoy it, you come back. And I learned a lot from it actually. So we used to do like climbing, canoeing, loads of different activities, and they were really fun, great activities, work a team a lot of the times. And it was great just to be out the house, have that bit more routine. It just really helped us to kind of get over that lull. And then I got the opportunity to going to be a young ambassador, which was a fantastic thing. It was, again, that kind of got us into something I never would have thought I would ever do. That's public speaking. And I absolutely loved it. Yeah, I got to do some incredible events. I got to raise a lot of money for them, which I'm proud of. Got to experience different side of life, and I've really enjoyed it. Got to do traveling with it. Got to go to London all the time. And I was a really happy time in my life, to be honest. Yeah, so I was really, really honored to do all of that. And then now, basically, I'm just trying to think back to what I'm doing now, really, is obviously with COVID and all that, it's kind of traveling's all stopped. And but anyway, I've got into doing Mental Health Foundation Trust in my area, which is CNTW, which is classed as Cumbria, Northumberland, Tyne and Wear. And it's basically the service I used. And basically, I'm very proud to be a governor, to be a voice for other people, to help improve the service, to help fight for what I think is best for the service user or patient, and just get the best care and best, yeah, everyone should have the best care, best quality of service out there, really. No one should have to suffer alone. No one should have to kind of deal with the hard crap that mental health can be, basically.
Yeah, I think that's so important. I think you're doing a fantastic thing there to kind of improve the services. And I think, like you've said, with everything, like, we are making way, but there's still a long way to go. So having people like yourself, you know, so passionate about giving back to others, especially, I'm sure it means a lot to you doing it for the service that you were under as well. And the last question that I wanted to ask you today was, I guess, let's point it more specifically to male eating disorders. But if someone is listening, whether they're somebody that, you know, is supporting someone with an eating disorder, or if they, you know, feel like they have an eating disorder themselves, what would be your top tip or your best advice for somebody to get help?
So I'm going to go on two, because I think if you're a parent looking after a child, then I would say for you, so no matter what your child says or whoever you're looking after or whatever it is, get them help. They'll not want it, but in the long run, they'll give you the biggest hug ever imagined. After years, they'll give you the biggest hug ever imagined, because they'll realise what you've done. And they'll realise that, yes, they might have given you a lot of grief, and they probably will give you a lot of upset and grief and heartache, but you've done the right thing. If you're somebody struggling and you don't know what to do, again, I suppose it's similar. Again, I guess it's about delving deep into yourself and really sitting and thinking. You must have got to points within that you know that that's not you. You know that that's odd. I should be able to do that. That shouldn't happen. I shouldn't feel like I can't eat this, or I shouldn't feel like I have to go and walk or whatever it is. It should be, I'm doing that as an enjoyment, or I'm doing that as just I want to, not as I have to. And I think taking them little points, taking them, because it won't happen every day and it won't happen all the time, but when you do get them, really take them and think, right, that's why I need to get help. That's why I need to fight hard, unfortunately, to get help. You shouldn't have to fight hard to get it, but unfortunately you will. You've just got to keep thinking about them little points that you think to yourself, I don't want that to happen again, or I don't want something like that to come around again. And just kind of hold on to that and focus on that, and you'll be all right in the end. You'll be all right. You'll get through it, and you'll be a better person for it, really, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you so much, Tom. It's been so lovely to speak to you. And I just want to say thank you again for being so honest and open about your experience. And I think, honestly, you're such an inspiration to have been through what you have and now giving back, which is just fantastic to hear.
Yeah, I just want to say thank you very much for all of that. And yeah, I'm sorry that I kind of waffled on so much, really.
No, it's been absolutely lovely to listen to you waffle on. Better than you just giving me a one-word answer and being like, okay, next question.
You've probably missed, if anyone's listening while on a train or anything, they've probably missed that stop. And they're probably like late to the next meeting or something. But,
absolutely.
Yeah. But thank you very much.
I think that episode with Tom was really eye-opening and really interesting to hear about the link between his anxiety, autism and anorexia. I think also it's so important that we are raising awareness of male eating disorders because they can often be forgotten about or not even known about. Next week, I'll be joined by Suzanne Samarka. Suzanne has a project called Honesty About Editing, and it's all about the impact that editing images on social media can have, especially on young children.
And there was a girl of about 13, 14 sitting next to me, using her phone as a mirror, which we've all done, with a filter on. And it broke my heart. And I remember just thinking, if you can't bear to look at your own image without a filter that nobody else is going to see. Yeah. You're putting your lipstick on or whatever it be. What does that mean for you? What are the voices in your head telling you? And at such a young age and an impressionable age as well.
If you enjoyed listening today, you won't want to miss next week's episode. So be sure to subscribe to be one of the first to hear it. Please also like, comment and share this podcast with anyone you feel that may need support at the moment. Not only those struggling with eating disorders, but also their loved ones, as this can be a very difficult time for everyone. Eating disorders are crippling illnesses, and this podcast aims to motivate and inspire individuals along their path of recovery. If you are struggling with an eating disorder, charities like Beat, Seed and First Steps have great resources. Please also reach out to your local GP to see how you can gain support for your eating disorder. See you next time. Bye.